This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 30, 2004. At KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Democratic presidential candidates debated last night in South Carolina. A criminal justice reform bill is before the Connecticut legislature that could change mandatory minimum sentences. And California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger faces the first clemency appeal of his administration. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Amma Insiabwadi with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. It was reported yesterday on the website CNN.com that Republican Representative Billy Torzin of Louisiana, one of the 20 co-sponsors of the new $540 million Medicare prescription bill, received an offer worth more than $1 million to represent the main pharmaceutical lobbying group, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Ivy Fitzgerald has more.
Consumer advocacy group Public Citizen is calling for an ethics investigation into allegations that Republican Representative Billy Torzin was negotiating a job offer with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America while writing the Medicare bill, which may mean that the offer influenced the increased benefits for pharmaceutical companies under the Medicare prescription bill. Public Citizen alleges Torzin slipped news of his retirement from Congress in November while writing the bill, this only 2 months before the job offer was announced. Craig Holman, campaign finance lobbyist for Public Citizen, says that without an investigation, Torzin accepting the job would still be a manipulation of House rules against lobbying Congress immediately after retirement.
He just will hire other lobbyists to do his lobbying for him. The problem is that any member of the House, if they're contacted by someone from pharma, they're going to know they're indirectly being contacted by Torzin.
Public Citizen's accusations have not been answered by the Ethics Committee. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ivy Fitzgerald.
The Jamaican town of Spanish Town is under siege from what many describe as criminal gangs drawn from the opposite sides of that country's political spectrum. In the past 2 weeks, some 12 people have been killed and 20 others have been injured as the groups battle for control of the town's extortion racket. FSRN's Ian Forrest reports.
Spanish Town's civic, political, economic, and religious leaders are frantically trying to find ways to defuse the current turf war between the rival One Order and Klansmen gangs. Among the many residents caught in the middle is Leonard Smith, a 19-year-old resident of the town. He didn't go to school today for fear that he would not be able to make it back home. The violence, he says, is also making a dent on his social life.
Before in the evenings, you could play basketball and stuff. But now, we have to cut that and get off the road as the evening comes. Because, you know, anything can happen.
He believes the recent curfews by the police have done much to curb the retributive attacks by members of the gangs and is hopeful that the work of the town leaders and the police may soon bring an end to the violence. Reporting for FSRN, I am Ian Forrest.
The Pentagon yesterday announced the release of three, quote, enemy combatants from Guantanamo Bay. Three young teenagers were captured in Afghanistan and held in Cuba since early 2003. Jackson Ellis reports from WBAI in New York.
The three boys, thought to be between the ages of 13 and 15, were captured during U.S.-led military incursions into Afghanistan in late 2002. Pentagon officials say the boys, quote, no longer posed a threat to national security. Much criticism has been leveled at the Bush administration's classification of post-911 detainees. Stephen Watt of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City says the enemy or unlawful combatant designation avoids international conventions given to prisoners of war.
The term enemy combatant has no meaning under international or domestic law. There are a slew of rights that are extended to them which are not being extended to the detainees at Guantanamo.
According to government statistics, there are approximately 660 detainees from 42 countries held as enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials say aid groups will help the three teenagers reintegrate into Afghan society. Jackson Allers, Free Speech Radio News, New York City.
Tens of millions of Super Bowl Sunday viewers would have seen a 30-second ad this weekend depicting children laboring in adult jobs and ending with the question, guess who's paying off President Bush's $1 trillion deficit? But television broadcaster CBS has refused to air the ad, funded by MoveOn.org, saying it is too controversial. Sandra Orton has more on this story.
The ad, critical of the Bush administration, will not be broadcast on CBS, which is owned by Viacom. Viacom has directly benefited from the Bush administration's recent changes in media ownership rules. Robert McChesney, media analyst, explains why CBS may be censoring ads that are critical of the Bush administration.
This effort is opposed by the overwhelming majority of American people and by the Congress, both the Senate and House. In fact, this in the past year, both the Senate and the House have voted to keep the ownership limit on the number of TV stations a single company could own nationally. The vote in the House was 400-21. But while this is going on the floor of the House and in public, behind closed doors, the Bush administration has been leading the fight to raise these limits, very much doing the bidding of Viacom and Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, leading the fight so they can buy more and more media.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, claims that the provision increasing media ownership rules was sneaked into the omnibus appropriation bill that passed last week and was signed by the president. At the Urbana IMC, this is Sandra Otten.
I'm Amma Nsiabwadi for FSRN.
The Washington Post is reporting that both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, in their investigation of pre-war Iraqi intelligence, said that the failure was due, in part, to the fact that the analysis did not seriously consider that Saddam Hussein no longer had weapons of mass destruction. According to an unnamed congressional official, the committees have determined that the CIA relied heavily on circumstantial and outdated evidence and became over-dependent on satellite and spy plane imagery and communication intercepts. Meanwhile, Democratic presidential candidates debated last night in South Carolina, where they blasted President Bush on misleading the public on the reasons for going to war. Two of those same candidates voted in 2002 in the Senate to authorize the invasion. Our D.C. editor Mitch Jeserich has more.
On Thursday night, the remaining presidential candidates debated in South Carolina, a state that will decide next Tuesday on who to back for the Democratic ticket. With former CIA weapons inspector David Kay testifying on Wednesday that pre-war intelligence on Iraq was wrong, several candidates took the opportunity to blast President Bush on misleading the country into war, including Senator John Kerry.
This president broke every one of those promises to the American people.
As a U.S. senator, John Kerry has access to classified information concerning intelligence. Just before he voted in favor of invading Iraq in 2002, he said that, quote, the threat of Saddam Hussein with weapons of mass destruction is real, end quote. The line quite resembles what President Bush has been saying all along. In fairness, the classified information Kerry is purview to is controlled by the White House, and it is common for Congress to rely on the White House's interpretation of the data. Presidential candidate and Senator John Edwards also strongly supported the invasion. Edwards sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee that would give him additional information than what Kerry would have had, though congressional sources say that information is also controlled by the White House. In Thursday night's debate, Edwards was not as harsh on the Bush administration for the intelligence failure, but he does support an independent investigation to find out what went wrong.
I think it is not for the administration to get to the bottom of this. It's actually not for the Congress to get to the bottom of this. We, the American people, need to get to the bottom of this with an independent commission that looks at that will have credibility.
In a questionnaire given to the Democratic presidential candidates by a San Francisco-based group, War and Law League, five of the candidates responded to questions concerning the legality of war. In a question concerning presidential war powers, Senator Kerry and Edwards responded by saying that there are times when a president can unilaterally initiate military action in the national interest. Reverend Al Sharpton and Representative Dennis Kucinich responded that only Congress can make such decisions. Also, candidates responded to a question concerning preemptive strike, such as the invasion of Iraq. Kerry said that a preemptive strike would be called for in the case of imminent threat, the same argument used by the Bush administration to invade Iraq. Edwards replied, a military attack is justified in self-defense, but as part of a foreign policy, it may breach international law. Jordan Paust is an international law professor at the University of Houston.
I'm rather shocked, actually, by Senator Kerry's remarks about preemptive war. He expressly accepted a notion, which is really false in international law, that the United States can engage in a preemptive war when there's a so-called imminent threat to our security. Even the phrase imminent threat is sort of oxymoronic because an imminent threat logically is not even a threat. This is quite different than Denis Kucinich's statement, where he recognizes these very points about international law and goes on to state that the U.S. Constitution binds the president, as any government official, to follow treaty law of the United States.
Several candidates didn't respond to the questionnaire concerning the legality of war, which Janet Hasberg with the War and Law League says is as informative as the questionnaires that were returned.
Joe Lieberman did not see fit to even respond, and also who our front runner at the time, Dr. Dean, did not see fit to respond. We also did not get a response, although we got an intended, you know, response, and then no response from Wesley Clark. So this, to me, is scoffing at the survey itself and the legitimacy of our questions.
Paul Lovinger, also with the Law and War League, says it's important to look closely at the Democrats' position on the use of the military, because he says it's not just Republican presidents that have gotten the United States into what he calls illegal wars.
Both parties have violated the Constitution. Both parties have violated international law. Since 1950, when Harry Truman sent troops to fight in a three-year war in Korea, the Constitution has been violated because it's up to Congress to declare the wars under the Constitution. And almost every president since Truman has been imitating him in his starting of aggressive wars without congressional approval.
To view the complete candidates' questionnaire, you can go to the War and Law League's website at www.warandlaw.homestead.org. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
You're listening to the reporter-run newscast Free Speech Radio News. As major news networks ramp up their election coverage, questions are being raised as to the diversity of programming available in media markets across the country. When the FCC approved new and looser media ownership rules in June 2003, it received an overwhelmingly negative response from the public. Thousands of letters were sent opposing the rule changes, many noting big media's poor track record on providing programming relevant to the needs of local communities. And this week, in a belated public relations maneuver, FCC Chairman Michael Powell responded to complaints by forming a task force to hear public concerns. On Wednesday, the task force held its second of six public hearings in San Antonio, Texas. KPFT's Renee Feltz reports.
We seek here to determine anew the level and character of local broadcast service being provided today and to consider what behavioral rules and policies the Commission might adopt or what legislative changes it might recommend to promote and improve the local service of broadcasters.
FCC Chairman Michael Powell and the four FCC commissioners met a public overwhelmingly dissatisfied with the effects of media consolidation on local programming. Roughly 500 people from San Antonio and Texas attended the hearing. Many, like T.C. Calvert, jostled to get in line for two public comment sessions.
San Antonio, Texas experiences a lot of floods. I live in a neighborhood where there's flood zones, just like other people across this United States who live in neighborhoods where there's a lot of toxins, where there's a lot of chemical plants. But I live along an area called the Salado Creek, and we had a 100-year flood that came to my neighborhood, Brother Powell. You should have seen the water coming. It was scary. People were scrambling for their lives. The fire department had put their lives on the line. The police department had put their lives on the line. Our television stations in our area, the fiber optics and the cable, were shut out. Our TVs went black. The people in our community listened to a clear channel communication station called KSJL Radio. You know what they were doing while the floodwaters were coming? They were bopping the music, hits and oldies, sort of warning our people that the floodwaters were coming.
Calvert's comments reflected the FCC's failure to divorce the issue of localism from media deregulation begun in 1996 by the Telecommunications Act. When the act lifted the 40-station ownership cap, San Antonio-based Clear Channel grew to own more than 1,200 stations. Many of those stations saw local news and music programming replaced with conservative talk shows. Critics say the Clear Channel example shows how deregulation allowed radio licensees to stray away from using the public airwaves to serve the public interest. Wednesday night, some comments included positive accounts of Clear Channel's support for local nonprofit organizations. But Michael Copps, one of two commissioners who oppose media deregulation, put these comments into context.
Some of our panelists and commenters seem to confuse such things as conducting blood drives and fundraising for charities with the sum total of their public interest responsibilities. Now, these fundraising activities are commendable activities, to be sure, but they are only part of a broadcaster's responsibilities to the community.
Esperanza Peace and Justice Center, a community center and art gallery that helped organize people to attend Wednesday night's hearing, is one example of a local nonprofit left out of Clear Channel's community outreach efforts, but included in its coverage. Founder and director Graciela Sanchez says the company exhibited its conservative agenda after the center won a lawsuit to keep city funding for its progressive programs.
We thought everything had been successful, but instead in October, November of this year, the radio station and the TV station owned by WAI came on the air and for a whole week started attacking the Esperanza and talking about our gay agenda and asked people in city to go and, you know, and challenge the city's bringing us back into the city funding and, you know, because we were pro-gay. And so, you know, here we are having to respond and, you know, start up again to challenge those racist, sexist, homophobic remarks that Clear Channel is allowing its radio and TV announcers to promote and present.
While mobilizing around the FCC hearing, Esperanza Center worked closely with an organizer from the Prometheus Project, a group responsible for holding up the FCC's deregulation efforts in federal court. That case is expected to be heard in the next 2 weeks. Leaders in the U.S. House are still considering a vote on a resolution that would overturn the changes. The Senate already approved the resolution. Meanwhile, the debate over media consolidation continues. From San Antonio, Texas, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger faces the first clemency appeal of his administration. Schwarzenegger will be deciding the fate of a man scheduled for execution for four murders committed in 1983. Supporters of the clemency say there are serious problems with the evidence presented at the condemned man's trial. Six jurors from the trial have joined in asking for clemency. FSRN's Christopher Martinez reports from KPFA.
Kevin Cooper is scheduled to die at San Quentin Prison on February 10th, but several jurors from his trial are asking Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to grant clemency. Schwarzenegger has denied a clemency hearing, making him the first governor to deny a clemency hearing to a death row inmate since California reinstated the death penalty in 1978. A spokeswoman for Schwarzenegger says the governor's office is in the process of reviewing Cooper's clemency application. Former boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter is among those urging clemency. Carter was himself wrongfully convicted of murder. He spent 20 years in prison before his conviction was overturned in 1988. Carter spoke at a news conference across from the state capitol.
And I am so glad to be here. I am really pleased to be here. In fact, I'm really pleased to be anywhere today.
Carter is the executive director of the Toronto-based International Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. He sent Schwarzenegger a letter asking him to delay Cooper's execution.
Why is there such a clamor and rush to carry out death sentences, but no similar urgency in freeing one who may be wrongly convicted?
Supporters of clemency say there were problems with the evidence at Cooper's trial. Actor Mike Farrell is the president of Death Penalty Focus.
We urge Governor Schwarzenegger to commute this sentence to life in prison without possibility of parole if necessary so that the evidence can be continued to be examined and lawyers can continue to work to free a man who may be innocent.
Farrell says problems with this case are typical of problems with the death penalty across the nation. A recent study in the Santa Clara Law Review found 80 flaws in California's death penalty system. That study is posted on the Death Penalty Focus website. Kevin Cooper was convicted for the 1983 murder of a couple, their 10-year-old daughter, and her 11-year-old friend. Lanny Davis is one of Kevin Cooper's lawyers. He was special counsel to President Clinton. Davis says police and prosecutors mishandled and possibly tampered with evidence. Evidence like bloody coveralls a woman gave to police, telling them she thought her boyfriend might have been involved in the murder. Police later destroyed the coveralls without testing them or telling the defense. Jurors never heard about that. Davis says other evidence that was presented at Cooper's trial casts doubt on the prosecutor's case. That evidence includes statements from the boy who survived the attacks, who said three white or Latino men killed his parents and friend. Cooper is African American.
The entire prosecution's case, to this day, is based on the premise that one person, Kevin Cooper, murdered four people with three murder weapons within a minute and a half to 2 minutes.
Six jurors from Cooper's trial have written letters to Governor Schwarzenegger asking him to grant clemency. One juror writes, "There are just too many unanswered questions, and frankly, I find them pretty damn disturbing." Another juror writes, "Because the murders were so atrocious, at the time I let the police misconduct go and sentenced Mr. Cooper to death. I now regret that decision." Schwarzenegger will be deciding on the clemency petition in the next few days. The last California governor to grant clemency to a convicted murderer was Ronald Reagan in 1967. Reporting from Sacramento for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christopher Martinez.
An announcement today that fourth quarter profits at ExxonMobil rose some 63%, with the oil giant saying it benefited from higher prices for crude oil and natural gas. This dramatic increase comes as the U.S. is facing three storm systems which are affecting the country this week, and the National Weather Service has issued warnings and advisories from Washington State to Maine. The snow removal budgets of municipalities are being strained by rock salt prices that have climbed from $34 a ton to $52 a ton in the last few weeks. Although natural gas storage appears to be sufficient for this winter's heating needs, our ability to keep away the cold by burning fossil fuels is in permanent decline, and the government has only short-term solutions. KPFA's Kelly Ramirez files this report.
U.S. natural gas supplies are stored in over 400 places to use during the peak heating and cooling seasons. Recent weeks of very cold weather in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Midwestern states have significantly increased the drawdown of those natural gas stores. But Jim Thompson, a natural gas industry analyst with the Energy Information Administration, says the inventory is still in good shape.
Right now, I wouldn't say that there are very many concerns about the adequacy of our working gas inventories.
But prices are high. The spot price at the Henry Hub wholesale gas market in Louisiana is the industry's benchmark. Thompson says that the last time Henry Hub had spot prices for natural gas at $2.50 or less per million BTU was before the winter of 2000. On January 29, 2004, the Henry Hub spot price was nearly $6 per million BTU. High wholesale prices for natural gas raise other costs. At a recent Interior Department teleconference, Bob Stallman, president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, noted the increase in farmers' production costs.
The past growing season alone, the price of farm inputs and energy-related production costs, those items and tasks that are essential to growing our crops, those costs have increased 30% to 40%. The biggest hit has been the increased cost for anhydrous fertilizer. 90% of the price tag for this essential fertilizer originates from natural gas.
Jim Thompson says we are not likely to see again the lower gas prices of 5 years ago.
Our domestic resources are being stretched, you know, to the point where productivity of wells is decreasing. The gas that's going to be coming online over the next 10 or 15, 20 years is going to be harder to recover. It's going to be more expensive to bring to market.
The Interior Department wants to increase domestic energy supply by drilling on federal land. Last week, Secretary Gail Norton announced that she wants to triple the number of permits approved annually for gas drilling on federal land in Wyoming's Powder River Basin, and that she's approved a plan to open nearly 9 million acres of ecologically sensitive land in Alaska's North Slope to oil drilling. Norton is also proposing financial incentives for the extraction of an estimated 55 trillion cubic feet of natural gas lying deep under the Gulf of Mexico. Secretary Norton.
America's energy security depends in large measure on the energy resources of federal lands, which account for about one-third of all domestic energy production. That also includes the offshore areas that we manage.
Energy security is a long-term issue, but the Bush administration is focusing on short-term solutions. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that there is only about 8 years' worth of natural gas in five western state parcels of federal land, including the Powder River Basin. Charles Clusen of the Natural Resources Defense Council says Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve contains only about 6 months' worth of economically recoverable oil that will take 10 years to get to market. And by Norton's own estimate of American natural gas usage, 22 trillion cubic feet per year, the 55 trillion cubic feet deep in the Gulf of Mexico are only about 2.5 years' worth of gas. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Mandatory minimum sentences have come under attack not only from people caught in the system and their families, but from judges who complain such sentences undermine their own authority to impose an individually crafted penalty on an individual defendant, saying one size does not fit all. Increasingly, legislators are also beginning to oppose mandatory minimums as unjust. In Connecticut, these forces are coming together to push a criminal justice reform bill in the legislative session about to get underway. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
With the temperature hovering around zero, about 20 members of a group called People Against Injustice rallied recently outside the courthouse in downtown New Haven. They were there to support Shelton Tucker, an African American who served a year in jail on an assault charge when he was 16. Now married with three kids, Tucker is a member of People Against Injustice who has encouraged defendants who claim innocence to reject plea bargains. Tucker, who is 29, now had to face his own decision of whether to accept a plea deal of a suspended sentence and probation for a charge of drug possession with intent to sell, or go to trial and face at least 8 years in prison if convicted. Of the charge, he says,
"That is absolutely not true, positively not true, at all."
But in the end, he couldn't risk jail time and took the deal. His supporters stood up in the courtroom and unfurled a large banner that proclaimed, "No justice in the war on drugs," before walking out. Tucker is the son of Barbara Fair, one of the founders of People Against Injustice.
Our justice system says we have a right to a fair trial. The thing about it, many of the people in here know they're not going to get a fair trial, and that's why they feel they have to plea bargain.
That, she says, has a lot to do with racism.
They don't pick people that are of our peers, as the Constitution says. They don't pick people like that. They pick people out in the suburbs who the only time they probably see us is when we're on the TV with handcuffs on us.
Mike Lawler agrees that racism, often institutional racism, plays a critical role in the criminal justice system. Lawler is a former prosecutor who co-chairs the Connecticut General Assembly's Judiciary Committee. For example, in the legislature's war on drugs, it passed a series of laws that require a mandatory minimum sentence of 3 to 5 years for selling drugs within 1,500 feet of a school, daycare center, or public housing project. Selling is so broadly defined that it includes two adults sharing a joint of marijuana in their own home after school hours when no students are anywhere around. Virtually all the streets of Connecticut's largest cities are included under the law's provisions. The vast majority of the state's blacks and Latinos, who make up 19% of Connecticut's population, live in urban areas, so they are disproportionately targeted by this law.
As a consequence, it should come as no surprise that even though half the people who get arrested in Connecticut for drug law violations are white, 9 out of 10 of the people who actually go to prison for drug law violations are either African American or Latino. And the end result is, of the almost 20,000 people in prison in our state, 72% are African American or Latino. And that's, by itself, an injustice.
Lawler adds that conviction rates are higher for those who can't afford to post bond before trial or before a plea bargain is reached. This discriminates against the poor, who are disproportionately people of color. A few years ago, the legislature voted to give judges discretion in sentencing under the 1,500 feet law, but mandatory minimums are still in place for all other drug offenses, and defendants with a long or violent criminal record are not eligible for discretion. People Against Injustice is supporting a bill that Representative Mike Lawler will introduce when the General Assembly's 2004 session begins on February 4th. Among other things, it would allow for first and second time nonviolent drug offenders to go straight to treatment and not to jail, thus eliminating the whole issue of plea bargains. The group would like to see Connecticut get rid of mandatory minimums altogether, as four other states and the District of Columbia have done. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.